This episode of the Coin World Podcast is brought to you by the Coin World Marketplace. The Coin World Marketplace is the safest way to buy and sell your coins and bullion. Order from the dealer of your choice and pay safely and securely using our escrow checkout. Visit coinworld.market to browse our inventory today. Welcome to the Coin World Podcast. Here are your hosts, Chris Bullfinch and Jeff Stark.
Welcome to the Coin World Podcast. I'm Jeff Stark.
And I'm Chris Bullfinch.
And today we have a wonderful, well, conversation with Phil Mussel, who's one of the owners and a publisher at Token Publishing, which is, the United Kingdom's largest numismatic publishing outfit. We had a great time discussing the market there and learning all sorts of things and catching up since it's been quite a while because of the whole pandemic. We think that'll be fun for you to learn about that area, as well as our usual bevy of numismatic trivia and forays down the hallowed halls of numismatic history.
And if you enjoy those forays, or if you enjoy our conversation with Phil Mussel, please keep on listening every week. Go back and listen to any previous episodes you might not have caught, and subscribe on whichever platform you get your podcasts. So our conversation with Phil was pretty wide-ranging, but I think our shared interest in numismatic history really animated it and made it, you know, very, very enjoyable. So what was happening this week in numismatic history, Jeff?
It's amazing how every week, no matter where we are in the calendar year, you know, we've been doing this a year and a half now, I think, a little more than. There's always something that we can key in on and say, oh yeah, that's kind of a big deal. Let's go to October 20th. 1986, so that's in my lifetime, not yours. But what happened on October 20th, 1986? Well, that was the day the American Eagle gold bullion coins were released. So that's kind of a big deal to us here in the American market, and really the world, because the American Eagle, being America's bullion coin, is collected around the world and sold around the world. I feel like I'm cheating when I bring this in there, but you know what? It's our show. We make the rules and we can break the rules. Something else caught my eye in this week, and I think it's too neat to share for a couple reasons. It's a long time ago, October 19, 1872. It's not in the U.S. We have to go to Australia, specifically to New South Wales, when the world's largest gold nugget was found there. And of course, you know, anybody who knows a little bit about gold mining history around the world knows how important Australia is to that story. I reference this because about a month ago, I got to talk to some folks who found gold nuggets, not nearly as big as this record size, but it was really cool to talk to these folks. They found two nuggets, 85 ounces and 40 some ounces, somewhere around there. So, you know, you think an ounce is like $2,000 almost. That's a lot of money. Well, should I use this as the trivia question or should I answer it now? What do you think? Because I was going to go a whole different direction with the trivia question, but this just came to me.
Why don't we leave the audience in suspense and save it as a trivia question? Okay. I think that would actually be kind of fun.
Okay. So that was totally unintentional. Maybe we should do two trivia questions. Who knows? But this, it was October 19th, 1872, down in Australia, the world's largest gold nugget was found. We will make reference to that later in the show when I pose it officially. And then you have to wait a week or until the next episode to find out the answer. So that's what was going on in the numismatic landscape that caught my eye. Then I went to the Coin World Archives and pulled down the big book from the shelf and blow off the dust. And then I opened the pages to see what was happening this week in Coin World history. So we went to the October 19th, 1983 issue. 1983 was chosen because that was the year of the founding of Token Publishing. What was on the front page of Coin World right then? It is interesting to note that there are some names in collecting, some collectors whose collections and whose lives live on long after they have. And in this case, the big news in this episode, or this issue, I should say, was that R. Henry Norweb, the famed numismatist, had died October 1st here in Ohio at Hanna House in Cleveland, and he was 88 years old. Now, R. Henry Norweb was one half of the indomitable duo of R. Henry and Emery May Norweb. The Norwebs are, I would say, among the top 20 important collectors in the 1900s in the U.S., at least, maybe even top 10, I would bet. What did they own? Why does their collection matter? Well, they donated a Brasher doubloon to the American Numismatic Society. They gave the proof 1913 Liberty Head nickel. You know, of course, there's only five of those known. They gave their 1913 nickel to the Smithsonian. And they gave a 52-piece collection of U.S. colonial coins to the Smithsonian. That's what they gave, donated. Of course, you know, they got a tax write-off. But they also had much of their collection was sold through a series of auctions by Bowers and Morena, or Bowers and Ruddy may have been the official company name at that time. I don't recall when they changed names. And I actually have a set of those catalogs in the other room. There's a certain number of catalogs that are sort of just, you got to have them if you're a serious devotee of U.S. numismatics. Norweb is one. Elias Berg's another. You know, and Elias Berg, I have some of the world stuff too, which is, it's not underrated, but everyone focuses on the fact that he had one of everything that was known at the time, which, my gosh, that's crazy and that's awesome. But the world stuff was pretty dang remarkable, too. Those are some of the more important ones. And a lot of this came out in the 1980s through Bauer's firm. So that was the big news that caught my eye. It's a reminder that our collections can live on after we do. And certainly, I don't expect Chris or I to have a collection of that renown. But there's always a place in numismatics for the future to look back and look at who was a collector at the time and think about what was going on in the hobby then. So what were the average collectors like you and I talking about on the letters page, Chris?
Well, so two letters jumped out at me this week, as they often do. And they both relate in one way or another to our conversation with Phil Mussel, which is why I picked them out. The first one is entitled Good Coins Still Circulating. And it reads, quote, "Old coins are still being found these days. I work in Santa Monica, California, and have collected coins for about 30 years. Frequently, I will take some of my numismatic material to work and share with anyone who's interested. Lately, a young man, Alan Bremer, has taken a keen interest in starting a collection. Alan asked my advice, and I told him that Jefferson nickels, in quote, are a good beginning for two reasons. First, the cost of a set of Jefferson nickels is relatively low. Second, and more important, most of the coins can be found today in pocket change. This brings me to the reason why I'm writing you this letter. This week, Alan purchased two rolls of nickels at a local bank. Saturday morning, while on coffee break, Alan proceeded to open one of the nickel rolls when out popped a very nice 1936 Buffalo nickel. Call it beginner's luck or whatever, we were amazed. That was the clincher. Numismatics has gained a new member, which pleases me to no end, Bob Northam from Los Angeles." And that jumped out at me because in our conversation, which you'll be hearing in a few minutes, we talked to Phil Mussel about the UK's circulating commemorative coin program, which was sort of similar to the 50-state commemorative quarter program. Phil mentioned that he thought that the 50-state quarters were very successful. And we've discussed this on the podcast before, but part of the appeal of that program was that there were collectible coins in circulation, which gave people a reason to check their change, and they could, you know, pick out quarters for each state, put them into a board. I mean, I did it beginning, you know, I've told the story in the podcast before about how I got into it when my dad brought home a couple of Littleton boards in probably the late 1990s, early 2000s. I guess it would probably be early 2000s. And that was one of a number of experiences that introduced me to numismatics. And I've been a collector and have started working at it professionally. So it can really change your life in a lot of ways. So I thought that letter was interesting, and it connected to our discussion about circulating collectible coins with Phil. Second letter is entitled Few Perfect. and it reads, all coins struck in the mint that haven't been run through chutes and into bags and carted off should be called MS65. The term MS should be discontinued and go to a percentage basis. I've seen only two perfect coins, and they were 1894 dimes, especially struck by the Mint Master, from Gael Chapman of Santa Rosa, California. I picked this letter out because we talked to Phil about the difference in grading ancient coins as compared to modern coins, and grading preferences between the UK and the US. Phil, again, I'll let him explain it better, but he essentially elaborated that in the UK, some people prefer to have their coins not be graded or slabbed, and they refer particularly to ancient coins with a different series of grading terms. So that letter kind of jumped out to me, and I thought the reference to the 1894 dimes was kind of bizarre. But anyway, those were the two letters that really kind of caught my eye, and they both, I think, dovetailed well with our conversation with Phil.
Yeah, I like the letter's reference to finding Jefferson nickels in circulation. Now, that, of course, was from 1983. I'm going to jump forward 13 years after that to 1996, when I was in high school, and I was working at Walgreens, and I would still find in circulation there, working the photo lab and the cash registers and all that, I would find 35% silver nickels in change, because they were often, to the layperson, almost indistinguishable. They're just another nickel. And at the time, you have to remember that silver was not worth anywhere near what it's worth now. And so I can even recall going to my bank. I was very fortunate, like the young man who is referenced in the letter. I bought some rolls of nickels, and I opened them up and found that they were all the silver nickels from World War II. So I asked the clerk, I said, any more like these? And I ended up with something like 23 rolls of silver nickels. I went ahead and sold them all on eBay, because, you know, remember, I was in high school at the time, and I got them for $2, and I think they sold for around $10 a piece at the time. Of course, now those are like $50 a roll plus coins, because the coins are like $1, $1.30, $1.40 melt and all that. But, you know, at the time, it was a huge score for just this, you know, punk kid in high school. And, you know, I had already been interested in coins, so I didn't need that as sort of a draw to get me hooked, but that certainly was fun. And, you know, despite the seemingly low monetary reward in the grand scheme of things, you know, now you go, oh, $200 or whatever, that's not a huge, well, it was at the time to me, but it has more meaning to me just as a memory and a story of my younger collecting time. So that, I don't know, that just felt fun to do a little self-reflection, a little navel gazing because of what I hear in the letter.
Oh, that's really cool. And you and I love sharing our numismatic stories, and we love to hear from the listeners some of their numismatic stories, how they got into it. And we often ask our guests that too. I think that everyone's sort of numismatic journey is worth exploring and worth thinking about. So thanks for sharing a little bit of yours.
Absolutely. Now, a few minutes ago, I referenced a trivia question. Before I officially pose that, I need an answer from you. I need answers. I need answers, kid. So, last week...
When did this become an interrogation?
You're going to tell me right now where the dame is, or she's going to get it. Anyway.
You got me down in the tombs. You have the
yeah, I don't have the light swinging. The 1930s, the guy with the fedora and the trench coat.
And chomping on a cigarette, yeah.
So we were talking about commemorative coins, so I found a question that was related to a classic commemorative. I know one of your favorites series and areas is classic commems. So I ask you, name the structure on the reverse of the Battle of Antietam commemorative half dollar. There's an iconic image or scene.
Landmark
is a perfect word. There you go.
That would be the Burnside Bridge.
You got it right. Imagine that.
Woo. Very shocking, but yes, that would be the Burnside Bridge.
So so named for General, is it
Ambrose? Ambrose Burnside.
Yeah.
His soldiers held off a Union assault for, I think, a number of hours right around that bridge. And it was, yeah, I think, one of the bloodier moments of the Battle of Antietam, which was the bloodiest battle in U.S. military history, I think.
Yeah. So you are correct. And Burnside, of course, is said to have been the inspiration for Sideburns. But I think there's some question about that with the facial hair experts. We're not experts in facial hair, although I will say that our esteemed colleague Steve Roach a few years ago wrote a very interesting story about facial hair and mustaches on coins, you know, people that are depicted on coins. And there are some hairy folks out there on classic world coins. But anyway,
I attended at the ANA show last year. I attended a meeting of the Bearded Coin Collectors Club.
Yeah, you're an SOB is what that means. No, you know what that is?
No.
Society of Bearded Numismatists.
Oh, maybe that's what it was.
Yeah, yeah, they're SOBs. Society of Bearded Numismatists.
Oh, I got the name wrong. Okay, yeah. Well, I mean, well, so I saw that and I have a beard and I thought, you know, I need to go be among my people.
Yes.
And so I went, yeah, no, that's that made me think of that. That's a cool topic, facial hair on coins. Facial hair in ancient coins would be cool too. And medieval coins, because some of those people had really interesting facial hair.
It was a cut above, I bet. A hair raising time. you snuck by the skin of your teeth or your chin of your teeth. Anyway,
you are on a roll.
I'm something anyway. So you were an SOB that day, which is day. You are
exactly.
Numismatist.
Jeff, I'm nothing if not consistent. I'm an SOB at the ANA show. I'm an SOB day to day. That's just how it goes.
Very good. So, officially now, I want you, since, you know, maybe that facial hair suggests a wisdom beyond your age, okay?
I don't know. I wouldn't go too far with that, but...
Think about what the answer to this question is. The largest gold nugget ever found, how big was it?
All right.
And bonus points if you can translate that into a rough dollar amount.
Okay. I will do my best.
So we'll have that in the next episode. But until then, what have you been reading? We need to talk about that. We always love books here.
Yeah, we do. And the book I read, again, it's weird. All the content for this podcast has really fit itself well with the interview. I read a book called Angels and Ducats. The subtitle is Shakespeare's Money and Medals. And it was written by Barry Cook, who is a curator in the Department of Coins and Medals at the British Museum, and the book was published in 2012, quote, to support and develop an exhibition held at the British Museum in 2012. So the book was really interesting. I'll confess to not being a Shakespeare expert at all. I've read some of his work in high school and college, but there were a number of references that he covered from plays and Shakespeare's work that I had not read, but his discussion was fascinating because he examined different facets of the sort of monetary history of Shakespeare's England. And he describes the cost of productions in Shakespeare's time, how much the costumes cost, how much they talked about how much the theater goers were paying and the coins that the theater goers would have paid with. It's really interesting because, you know, Shakespeare made quite a bit of money, but actors made very little, you know, and Cook describes all of that. But what I found most interesting about Cook's analysis was when he looked at the sort of monetary metaphors that Shakespeare used in a number of his plays. There's a whole range, you know, people use monetary metaphors all the time, whether they realize they are or not. But Shakespeare, in some cases, made sort of clever little in-jokes or references to coins, sometimes to say something about the characters, sometimes money was moving the plot. Most people reading Shakespeare probably wouldn't think twice when he references a groat or a shilling or a ducat.
And the reference to King Henry VIII's copper nose comes from the coin wearing out because it's had little silver because the king debased it because he needed money to fund his extravagances. And yeah, I mean, it's a great book.
Yeah. And so it's interesting to analyze the work of Shakespeare through a numismatic lens. And that gets me thinking about what other authors use these kinds of metaphors, and how could you read works of literature with sort of a numismatic eye? I found the book really, really interesting, and it's about 93 pages or so. It's really, it's beautifully illustrated. So it's a quick read, and it's really, really interesting. And it definitely, it got me interested in Shakespeare again. So yeah. Angels and Ducats by Barry Cook. Definitely, definitely add that to your numismatic library and give it a read. It was really interesting.
It's in mine, and it was instrumental when I wrote Coins of Shakespeare article several years ago. And I can only echo your high recommendation. And it is rather apropos that you were exploring the world of Shakespeare and England, because that's where our discussion now heads. We jump across the pond, metaphorically speaking, of course. We're not getting on airplanes right now. And we have a wonderful discussion interview with Phil Mussel, the publisher at Token Publishing. They produce Coin News, which is a monthly numismatic magazine in the United Kingdom. And boy, is it impressive. And they've won awards. He's done lots of publicity in UK press to talk about numismatic matters. And we get into just, you know, some of the differences of the market and some of the things that are going on in that realm of numismatics. And it was just a blast to reconnect with him. And we hope that you have as much fun sort of touching base and wandering down those paths as we did. Chris and I are delighted today to be joined by Phil Mussel, who is a co-owner of Token Publishing, which publishes Coin News and Metal News, as well as several numismatic books, all based in the United Kingdom. Thank you for being here today.
Hi, Jeff. Hi, Chris. Nice to join you.
So I have known you, I guess, going on maybe 10 years. Does that sound right?
It sounds about right. It's quite scary how quickly time goes, but 10 years sounds about right. Yeah.
Yes, it does. So you've come to a lot of US shows and all that to represent Token Publishing. What is Token Publishing and how long has that been around? Can you talk about the history of the firm?
Sure. Well, actually, we've been around for quite a while. We started back in 1983. It was my father's company. My father and mother started it up with one of Margaret Thatcher, our Prime Minister's wonderful enterprise initiative loans. They started the company to buy the magazine Coin and Metal News, which was actually owned by a gentleman called Erwin Margolis, an American gentleman who'd started Epic Publishing and bought the title Coins and Metals from Stanley Gibbons. So when he took over Coin and Metal News, he needed an editor. My father took over that role. And then 2 years later, he actually bought the company. So, or he rather bought the title and started the company Token Publishing. My parents split up in 88, but my father carried it on. And I joined him in 1996. So I've been with the company, gosh, 24 years now. And yes, as you mentioned earlier, we've published Coin News and Metal News magazines, plus a whole raft of numismatic books. So we've gone from just my mother and father in a single room above a plumber's shop in England here to now 12 members of staff. And we've got about two magazines plus dozens of different books. So we've certainly come a long way, but it has been 37 years. So.
Wow. So I couldn't help but notice this is a family business involved in numismatic coverage, but making a global impact. That sounds a lot like Amos Media.
Well, indeed. Yes, I know Rick very well. He's a lovely chap. And I think his business and our business does tend to reflect each other in that respect. You're absolutely right. Family businesses, I think if you look at the coin trade in general, there are an awful lot of family businesses. An awful lot of coin dealers have their children involved. And they in turn took over their businesses from their fathers and mothers. So it's the numismatics is a family business, I think. It's one big family, if I may be so cliched.
Yes. So you said you've been there since 1996. Today, your role is probably very different from then. I mean, I know from talking with you at shows and getting the magazine, you write the column at the front of the magazine every month. You know, you're doing all manner of things. Talk about your role and what that entails.
Well, my role is kind of, it's twofold, really. I'm officially the marketing guy. So I'm the chief marketing officer here. So I'm the forward face of the business. So I'm the one who goes to all the shows. I'm the one who does podcasts, radio, that sort of thing, in order to try and promote both the magazines and the hobbies, of course, because it's once you promote one, you promote the other. But I'm also involved in quite a reactive away, because I know quite a bit about coins now. I didn't when I first started, but obviously having been involved with the family for 37 years and then for the actual business for 26, I've picked up a little bit of knowledge. So what we tend to find is when all sorts of queries come in and people ask about the value of coins and whether or not something's real and that sort of thing, I get involved in that as well. So I've been heavily involved in the numismatic side as well as the marketing side. So although I've got a degree in marketing, it's actually used a lot less than a degree in numismatics would be, but sadly I haven't got one of those yet.
It's funny you talked about the educational side of the hobby, because I was curious. I think you're a collector, and I think you collect metals. Is that right?
That's correct, Jeff. Yes. I collect coins as well. I actually collect sovereigns. I started off just buying the gold for the gold's sake. But of course, as one does, one becomes embroiled in the actual numismatic side of it. So I'm now desperately picking up different die numbers and different dates, et cetera, et cetera. So I have become a coin collector as well. But no, I started off by collecting medals simply because I had an interest in military history. And the military side of things in England, in Britain, our medals were all named. Unfortunately, that's not the case necessarily in the United States, but our medals are all named with the actual name of the person who received them. So you were able to find the exact medal that had been awarded to a person for a specific act or for a specific battle, and were able to therefore look at his history. And that I found absolutely fascinating. And my first degree was actually in theology and philosophy. So I ended up collecting medals to chaplains. That was my big thing for a long time. But sadly, I had to sell that collection in order to finance the building in which I'm now sitting. So we bought our lovely Georgian building about 4 years ago. Well, at least we bought the leasehold. So we're here for 993 years. I don't know what the heck I'm going to do in the year 3000, but I'll get to that when I'll cross that bridge when I come to it, I guess.
So that's funny, but the serious side of the medals is the provenance. I mean, that you have the ultimate provenance with these medals bearing or carrying the names of the recipient, though the person who earned the medal.
That's right. That's the key thing. Now, what I collect at the moment is I actually collect medals to men from my hometown here of Exeter in Devon in the United Kingdom. And actually, I've got a number of medals from people who lived just a few doors away from me. And that, when you can actually sit outside somebody's house with a medal that he was awarded and just, you know, in your head say, look, you know, you haven't been forgotten. You know, you are still remembered 100 years on or 150 years on. You're still remembered. And here I am sitting outside your house with the medals that you would have worn. And that's quite something, I have to be honest.
That local aspect of the appeal of those medals reminds me of, though it's obviously not quite as interesting, it doesn't have the military history connection, but it reminds me of people who collect store cards.
Mm-hmm.
And in from the United States, which have a specific address where if the street still exists, you can go and try to find the address of the business or proprietor, whoever had the token created. Do you think that that kind of local connection, being able to anchor specific numismatic pieces in a local context, does that help you in terms of marketing? And how do you think that that kind of organic interest in certain aspects of numismatics can be used to more effectively market the hobby?
Well, certainly over here, we have a huge history when it comes to, I mean, you mentioned tokens. And back in the 17th and 18th century, we had a number of firms that were producing their own tokens. And that aspect of social history is huge. But I think one of the great things about coins is that you can hold in your hand a coin that was used by, if you're sitting in Hexham in Northumberland here, you can hold in your hand a coin that might very well have been used on Hadrian's Wall by a centurion who actually went into one of the local taverns and bought an amphora of wine. And you can actually hold that in your hand. So I think the aspect of holding history in your hands is huge. And I think this is one of the main reasons people get involved in collecting coins. They start off perhaps with their own coins from their pocket, but then they see something that's got an older date. Now, you guys over there have got a real advantage over us because all of our coinage stopped in 1971 when we went decimal and it started again. So we can only ever have in our pockets coins from Elizabeth II's reign. But you guys can you can go right back and get, and you could theoretically find an Indian head penny or a wheat penny in your change. Now that's fantastic because people look at those things, they get them and they wonder what it was. They look at it and wonder, gosh, is this a real coin? What was this? And then they start looking back and they start looking at the history of that. And I think that is a huge advantage to marketing the hobby, the history aspect of it. It's vitally important.
Excuse me. I want to go back to something that was, it struck me as poignant, but also sad in a sense that, you know, you can walk down the street and sort of point to a house where somebody once lived and this person was the recipient of this medal. That's an exciting proposition, but sad in the sense that the family hasn't felt it necessary to keep the medals and to remember their forebears' participation. How do people grapple with that sort of dilemma and that intersection of, you know, the history, but that it was very much a real individual that we're talking about and it represents?
Well, you've got two reasons people sell their medals and get rid of them. There's one is the fact that they simply didn't have any children or ancestors. It can be as simple as that. So somebody dies, they had no one to pass the medals on to. A friend comes in and just sells the whole contents of their house. That's it. And the medals get included. That's one thing that happens. But also often what happens is that medals get broken up and passed to three or four different members of the family. So, for example, in the First World War over here, we had three medals that were given to the participants who went over to France early. You had the 1914 or 1914-15 star, you had the British War Medal, and you had the Victory Medal. Now, if you then had three children, you come back from war and you've got these medals. If you have three children, all of whom are interested, who do you leave your medals to? Well, often people would leave them to one to each child. And that way groups get broken up. Now, years later, because there's only one medal and, you know, the other people didn't know great-granddad or great-great-granddad, that medal gets sold on. So you then have collectors who are trying desperately to put the groups back together. And they are trying, therefore, to put the meat on the bones, if you like, and put together the story of that person. And that way they are remembered. So just because medals are sold out of the family doesn't mean that the recipient is forgotten.
Okay, that's a great way to look at it, that it's a, you know, the backward sort of view. It's like you're putting the puzzle pieces back together.
Absolutely, yeah.
You talked about some of the difference in circulation in the U.S. versus the U.K. So let's talk about some other differences there, because you've obviously attended a couple dozen, at least, if not dozens, of coin shows in the U.S. during usual times.
I remember those usual times, Jeff. Yeah, I remember those.
I think we all do. It wasn't that long ago. I mean, you weren't in New York this year, I don't think, because you had the other York show.
That's correct. Yes, I had to go to Old York rather than New York. Indeed. I really felt I had to support my home show rather than the NYINC.
Sure. So, but other than that, I've seen you in New York for the last, like I say, I mean, I've been coming there every year since 2009. So obviously you're well in tune or exposed to the U.S. market. How does the U.K. market differ from the U.S. market? I throw in the caveat besides the obvious third-party grading proliferation.
Sure. Yeah, well, that's obvious. That is the obvious
one. Which we can explore.
Yeah, we can explore that at some point, indeed. But and the main difference is the breadth of collecting in the U.K., whereas the U.S. tends to concentrate more on U.S. coins, which is logical. So therefore, you've only got a limited period. We actually have this huge period of history, which the collecting world is in over here is broken up into more or less equal parts. You have Celtic coins from over 2,000 years ago. You have Roman coins. You have the hammered coins from 1,000 years ago. And you have Civil War coins. Then you come into the milled coins of, you know, the later ones from Charles II onwards. Then you've got the modern new issue coins that everyone has in their pockets. So I think what you have over here is a wider breadth, if you like, of collecting. Now, of course, people do collect ancient coins in the United States. Of course they do. There are many dealers out there, but it's not quite as prevalent, I don't think, in the United States as it is in the United Kingdom.
You know, here, people that collect ancient coins, they, of course, probably started with the traditional Lincoln Cent and all that. But once they get into that lane, if you will, they stay in their lane. Is that the case there in the UK? Somebody collecting the Roman stuff, still looking at, you know, maybe some milled things or trying to put together kings and queens? Or how does that work?
It's not quite the same level of I love the idea of just staying in your lane. That's a great way of putting it. I think, yes, you do tend to find that people who collect Celtic or people who collect Roman tend to stick to that. But the people who collect maybe, say, denominations, so you'll have people collecting shillings, they will collect hammered and milled. There will be people who will try and collect a penny from every single reign. So again, you're collecting, you know, from really from 800 up to the present day. And that's a heck of a range, really, you know, from the year 895 offer, King offer and the original penny right up to 2020. You know, that's a heck of a range.
And in so doing, you're creating an exhibit or a visual of the historical changes in monarchs, as well as the technological changes used to produce the coins.
Absolutely right. I mean, one of the big problems we've got over here is the hammered coinage. I don't know how familiar you are with hammered pennies of the Saxon era, but they are actually pretty much the same to look at. You know, it takes a real expert to differentiate the kings there. It wasn't really until Tudor times, and you've got Henry VII that was the first one to really use an image, if you like, of himself as opposed to a more generic monarch image. So the Tudor coins, if you look at the Tudor coins of Henry VII, Henry VIII, and Elizabeth particularly, you can recognize who they are straight away, particularly with Henry VIII and Elizabeth, who are so instantly recognizable. They are recognizable on their coins. And that was probably the first time, of course, the people of England actually got to see what their king or queen looked like. It's quite something. You mentioned about the different manufacturing techniques, because, of course, you know, that is something else that is... we've actually lost some of that. If you look at Greek coins, if you look at the Athenian owls and things like that, we cannot replicate today how they were made. You know, how were they made? Were they cast? Were they struck? Well, we don't really know exactly how some of these beautiful coins, were they carved? What were they? Because throughout the Dark Ages, throughout the Saxon period, the Viking period, that technology was completely lost. It wasn't until Charles II or Charles I, Charles II time that we got milling and we actually started getting some high relief again. So, you know, looking at the different technologies used in coins is actually an entirely fascinating subject all on its own, I think.
Absolutely. So can you talk about the grading, though? Because I know that, you know, here in the U.S., collectors are so sensitive to finest known and all that. And, you know, it's got to have, is it going to cack? Is it going to, you know, what's the grade going to be? All these things. And obviously, you don't have those concerns with some of the pieces that were struck in such a crude manner, if you will, technologically. But even with stuff that is machine struck, you know, the bulk of the last few hundred years and all that, that isn't as important as a consideration there.
No, you're right. I think the grading, the whole idea of slabbing, let's call it that for the sake of argument. The whole idea of slabbing is a very American one, which is slowly taking off over here. But it's going to be a while, I think, before we really embrace it in the same way as you have in the US. The whole idea of the slabbing of the coins and the grading of the coins is one of those that people... It's funny because people like to hold their coins over here. They actually like to hold in their hands the same coin as a Roman centurion or a Tudor merchant like to hold. Yeah. And you have a step back when you've got that plastic slab on it. And that's why it hasn't quite taken off over here quite so much. But the idea behind grading is very much that, as you know, it can change the cost or the price of a coin by a huge amount. So therefore, we tend to find that grading being a subjective thing means that dealers and collectors can put their own spin on it. And they can decide in their heads what they want that grade to be. So, for example, if a dealer puts something as VF plus, then the collector will take that and he'll pay a VF plus price. But in his head, he's happy that that is actually an EF coin. He thinks that's an EF coin. That makes him extremely happy to look at that and think that coin's an EF. If you've actually got a number on it, then there is no subjectivity involved. It is a third party that's decided to grade that, and there is no element of, well, I would have put that as an EF. It doesn't matter what you would have put it at, because ultimately, you know, it's been graded as an MS60 or whatever. So I think people do like that idea of being able to be slightly subjective themselves.
So my understanding, and then, you know, this is, I'm just a trained monkey a little bit. There are different grading standards, though, in the UK than the US, right? And how does that work? How do you square that circle?
What you've got, we don't have the infinitesimal grades that you have. So, for example, you know, when you've got MS, you know, MS60 up to MS70, you've got 61, 62, 63. We don't have that. We have extremely fine. Now, individual dealers will put extremely fine plus or almost mint, and it's up to the individual collector how he wants to interpret that. So essentially, we've got extremely fine, we've got very fine, we've got fine, then we've got good and fair. So most coins that you find, most numismatists, most coin collectors will want to get their coins in very fine or extremely fine. But of course, there are certain ones that you just are never going to find in that grade. And of course, if it's a real rarity, if there's only a few of them around, then it doesn't matter quite so much what the grade is. You'll take it in a fine example if you can't get anything else, purely because it's a very rare coin. So we don't have that real, you know, we don't have 10 different points or 5 different points in between each grading standard. We just simply have the extremely fine, very fine, fine, etc. And now people will put almost EF or EF plus if it's got a nice bloom on it or whatever. But there isn't, it's more of a, far more of a subjective thing over here than it is in the US.
But is an EF in UK the same as the EF here? The words are the same, but is that?
Yeah, no, it's probably not. I would say really an EF is in effect MS. You know, an EF is one of those coins that is absolutely looks absolutely superb. An extremely fine coin, you would have to look at it probably under a glass to realize that it has been circulated.
So an EF might be an AU55, AU58, MS60.
No, probably more than that. Yeah, I mean, I would say probably more MS60 to 65, and then you've got uncirculated and brilliant uncirculated up from 65 to 70.
Okay. That I think that's an important distinction because that was something that surprised me. You know, I've been at CoinWorld now 17 years counting the internship, and early on, you know, somebody said, well, write about the grading standards. They're different. And I go, what do you mean? The words are the same. What is that? You know,
hey, isn't that just typical of the whole America, England thing? The words are the same, but the meanings are different.
And the spellings.
Well, that must create some confusion. I imagine that dealers in the UK who deal extensively in the US and vice versa, I would imagine that they get used to bridging that, let's say, a language gap.
Yeah.
Or at least they sort of acclimate themselves to the different terms. Does that present a challenge in the marketing or the publishing side at all? Do you find that you have to use different terms if you're going to be dealing, aside from the grading terms, obviously, do you find that you have to use a different vocabulary when engaging in an American numismatic setting?
Not quite so much, no. I mean, we do tend to find that apart from the grading, things are more or less the same. You know, everyone knows what a hammer coin is. Everyone knows what a mill coin is. You know, people talk about blanks and planchettes and P8-forts and everything else in the same regard. It's really only the grading that there's the major difference between the US market and the UK market. I think it's something that people are cognizant of. They are aware of it, but we would never presume to put our own grade on something. So for example, if a coin came up at auction and it was MS62, we would never say in brackets EF. We would not put that, you know, we as a rule would not put that subjectivity on that. It's MS62. That's what it's been sold at. That's what it is. And it's up to the individual collector if he wants to consider that to be an EF or a VF plus or whatever.
Right. So people who don't use the Sheldon scale or unfamiliar with the Sheldon scale or who just aren't all that interested in a specific numerical grade, but are rather using the larger brackets that you describe, EF, fine, etc. Why hasn't numerical grading caught on in the UK? You mentioned that people like to hold their coins and they like to sort of engage in the imaginative exercise of picturing Hadrian's Wall, like you said.
Yeah.
But to me, that answers the question about why don't they like slabbing? And lots of ancient collectors in the US are very leery of slabbing. They hate to see ancient coins in third-party slabs. But as far as the grading system, there is a different ancient grading system. But why do you think there's a leeriness or a lack of interest in a numerical grading, or what I guess I'm reading as a lack of interest in numerical grading system? Is it just that there is that subjectivity or that affinity for subjectivity you talked about?
I think it is. You see, the trouble with a numerical grading system is that it is so fine that if you don't have it in a slab, then it's an irrelevancy. Because what is an MS63 to you is going to be an MS62 to somebody else. And of course, after a while, if someone's handled it, it could drop down. So, you know, it's going to be one of those things that to have a numerical grading system, you have to have the slabbing. Because it's people will not look at something and say, well, that's 100% an MS63 unless it has been certified as an MS63. They're going to look at it and go, yes, that's roughly an extremely fine coin. And one person's extremely fine is going to be slightly different to someone else's extremely fine.
In here, even when something is slabbed as a particular number, people look at it and go, oh, that's nice for the grade, or that's bad for the grade, or that's, you know, I mean, right. There are even debates with that, at this level, is that lack of acceptance, if you will, or the confusing array or potentially confusing array and differences, is that a barrier for collectors?
No, I don't think it's a barrier. I think, most people, at the end of the day, unless you are purely in this as an investor, and of course, that's an entirely different thing. We never, at Coin News, we never encourage investment. We always say collect for the fun of it. So unless you're in it purely for an investment point of view, the subjectivity is actually what drives you. When you look at a coin, you make that decision whether it's worth what the money is being asked for it. You make the decision in your heart whether you believe, and it doesn't matter what it's graded officially. Okay, so the grade will give it a certain price. We know that. But if you don't like that coin, if you don't think that coin, it doesn't speak to you, then it doesn't matter whether it's called Extremely Fine Plus or an MS65. It doesn't matter. It's whether it speaks to you or not. This is why some people absolutely adore the bloom and the patina on coins and other people don't like them. I personally think that the bloom on a silver coin can be absolutely stunning. Other people hate it. They want their silver coins to be absolutely shiny as the day it came out of the mint.
Yeah.
It's very subjective in that regard. And I think if a coin speaks to you, then you will know it's the right one, regardless of the price. If it doesn't, and you've got to convince yourself to buy it, maybe move on.
I love that way to look at things. And we've talked a lot about hammered, milled, all these other things. Let's jump forward, and talk about some coins that are speaking to a certain number of collectors anyway, thanks, I think, to the Royal Mint. The Mint has used circulating commemorative coins and social media to drum up interest in coins and coin collecting. I would say, especially since 2011, with the release of the 29 different 50 pence coins for the 2012 Olympics in London. Is that assessment right? If it is, what has the Mint gotten right and what have they gotten wrong?
Right. Well, I think, yes, you're absolutely right. And of course, I wouldn't say they stole the idea. That's far too harsh. But they got inspiration for the idea from, of course, the States Quarters. That was incredibly successful, as you know, and encouraged a lot of people to become coin collectors. And the Royal Mint looked at that. I know because I was party to their discussions in the early stages. They looked at that and thought, that's a great idea. Coins that people make a set of, they can collect. And in this particular case, the Olympics were coming up. They thought it was a great idea to actually have coins that people could find in their pockets and that they could collect to make a full set. And as you say, there are 29 of them. So it's quite an impressive grouping if you can get them all. Some are rarer than others, but there are over a million or round about a million of each of them. So they're not rarities, but they're not being found in change anymore because people have taken them out. People have started collecting them. And then they looked at that and they thought, well, that's actually been very successful. So what else can we do? And one of the most successful things has been the Beatrix Potter set. Yes. Now, I'm not familiar with how well known Beatrix Potter is in the United States, but over here we all grew up with the tales of Peter Rabbit and absolutely Bunnykins and all sorts of other Mr. Todd and Jeremy Fisher, all of these people. Mrs. Tiggywinkle was one of my favorites, and these were incredibly successful as well. So what they did is they put out a lot of these coins. Now, again, there weren't that many of them, but some of them had a few more. There were 9-10 million of some, but there were only sort of a million Jemima Puddle Ducks. I think there were only about a million of them out there.
Yeah.
So when you've got 68 million people in the country. A million coins isn't that many, especially as an awful lot of people don't look at their coins. They just simply take their change and move on. So to have that theme was incredibly popular. And they've followed that up with Paddington and a few others. And they have been very, very, very successful. What have they done wrong? Well, there have been a few things in as much that they have produced some coins that aren't available to the general public. So you can only buy them as commemoratives. And that, in my opinion, is a shame because I think it would be great that we could get them all in our change. If I could change anything about their marketing strategy, that's what I would change. I would say, look, Royal Mint, get all of these things out there, get them in our change, get people to collect them, and I think you will find that people will love doing so. They've got a number out there at the moment, like the dinosaurs, that you can only buy in a pack, and that's great if you want them, but you're not going to find them in your change. And I think that's a shame.
I would agree. We're supposed to be pretty agnostic in our reporting and our, and so I don't write scathing, it's a shame they haven't done that. But I do, from a true collector standpoint, I think it is a little bit unfortunate that, like the state quarters, I can go to the bank and get $50 a quarters and probably put together a set of state quarters. Are they going to look the nicest? No, but many of them are going to look nice enough. When I was there, I love London. I've been to CoinEx Comics now, I think, three times. You know, I try to come twice a year. I was actually supposed to come there back in March. But last September at CoinEx, I picked up the Stephen Hawking and one other modern 50 pence. And, you know, I had to pay six pounds a piece for them.
Right.
Because the wholesale price to the dealer was £5 from the mint. So the mint was making something for 50 pence and selling it for 10 times that face value to a dealer. And the dealer was like, the best I can do is, you know, let me make a pound profit for it. And I bought a couple because that was the only way to buy them. I wasn't going to find them in change. And I do think that is, like I say, unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, that would be the only thing I would change. I love the fact that we've got coins that people are looking at. But when you get a situation where they can't look for them because they've actually physically got to buy them, that becomes a different kettle of fish entirely. And I just think it's a shame. You know, I'm not going to criticize the Mint for doing it because they are, after all, a business. But I think it would be great if we could get them in our change. It's as simple as that, really.
But that sort of interest and I dare say mania, because I'm part of a couple Facebook groups for collectors based there, and I see some of, you know, how they react to all this stuff, because I want to know what's happening on the grassroots level. I have Google News Alert set for certain numismatic topics, and it seems like not a week goes by or a couple weeks goes by without some tabloid news story about crazy prices for modern circulating commemorative coins. You know, how has that made reporting on collecting more challenging, and how has that affected collector interest? Because we know some of the things behind that aren't exactly so.
Let's be brutally honest about it, Jeff. They are, some of them are blatant fibs. They're lying to us. Unfortunately, what you have is a situation where the tabloid newspapers over here, they love sensationalism. So anything that they can spin as a sensational story, they will. So we frequently get the tabloids saying to us, or putting out there, coin listed on eBay for £50,000. You know, is your 50 pence worth £50,000? We saw this week that a Sherlock Holmes 50 pence was listed at £50,000. Is your coin a rare one? And then you read the story, and it says, no, the coin's only worth 50 pence. But of course, somebody is chancing their arm and they've stuck it on eBay just for the heck of it. Now, I don't know if you guys are familiar, but I've noticed this, and we actually produced a book called Spend It, Save It, which was aimed entirely at the market for the new issues. And for people who wouldn't necessarily consider themselves numismatists, but would, you know, they are collecting the new coins. And I studied a number of eBay accounts over a period of time. And I noticed that what people were doing is that they're listing a coin, an ordinary everyday 50 pence coin, for, say, £1,000 or £2,000. Shortly before the listing is due to end, it gets pulled. And it just says this coin is no longer available. You then note about a week later that the same coin is up for about £25. That's exactly the same coin. I've seen it. I've taken pictures of the pictures that are online. It's the same coin. But it's a different account. And what they do is that they list it at £25, and somebody out there has remembered seeing it for £2,000 and thought, oh my goodness me, that's a rare coin. It sold for £2,000. Well, no, it didn't. What they did is they simply withdrew the listing, but they made it look as if it had sold by saying this coin is no longer available. So when they listed at £25, this poor unfortunate soul who thought that it sold for £2,000 hits the buy it now button and thinks that he's got a bargain, and then tries to sell it himself for £1,000 or £2,000, thinking that it had sold previously for that price, only to realize that it's worth approximately, or exactly rather, 50 pence. And this is what's been happening. I noticed there were a number of accounts that did that. And of course, then you get some people who are listing things at £1,000,000 and hoping that they're going to get into a tabloid. And that happens occasionally as well.
And are these people, I mean, that's a known psychological technique called anchoring, and as well as, you know, duplicitousness. But are these sellers using that to then funnel interest to their other listings? I mean, because we've seen that in the U.S. with some things where people list something to get eyeballs, and then, oh, guess what? People are looking, that page on eBay says the seller's other items.
Absolutely, of course. And the thing is, they're not doing anything illegal. There is nothing to say that you can't put your 50 pence coin on there for £1,000,000. And if someone pays you £1,000,000 for it, well, good luck to you.
It's the one sucker theory.
Exactly. Absolutely right. These people are not doing anything illegal at all. What they are doing is they are, in effect, they are preying on people's gullibility. Well, fair enough. But, you know, as you say, it's the one sucker.
And greed.
Well, yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what's happening.
I mean, they're playing on other people's greed, and of course, they're exhibiting their own greed. But
That's exactly right, which is why we always say to people, and obviously, you guys are going to back me up on this, read about your subject. Learn yes. about it, you know, read all the time, check out the information.
That's something Jeff and I have talked about on the podcast a little bit is the corrosiveness of the duplicitousness that we're talking about. Because if someone, I think £1 million for a 50 pence coin would be a pretty extreme example. But if someone goes out and spends an inordinate amount of money on a coin that really wasn't worth it, and then they take it into a dealer hoping that they got a steal, or at least because they were made to feel that they got a good deal, and they're told that this coin is worthless and they've effectively thrown money away, they might understandably be a little bit jaded or a little bit cynical or suspicious of coin dealers, or it might even turn them off of numismatics entirely. How do you see the work that you publish and the work that your company does and informing people and trying to publish content that sets the record straight or provides high quality, accurate information? That seems vital to me. How do you see your role in disseminating accurate information in terms of the health of the hobby?
Well, the problem we have, Chris, is that the people who are doing this, the people who are going out there and hoping to make a quick buck, generally won't read our magazine. They won't read our books because they're only in it for the money. And this is the biggest sure. problem we have. Because, you know, these guys, the ones who actually go out there and think I've made a fortune on this, they aren't interested in numismatics. They aren't really interested in the hobby. All they're interested in is making some money. But what we have to do is we have to avoid the younger people, particularly, from falling into the trap. Because obviously, when you are 12, the idea of making a few pounds on something is very, very appealing. And as a consequence, you have these collectors, these young collectors who are buying the coins, they're going out there finding coins, buying coins, and they're hoping that they're going to make some money. But we hope that they won't, because we hope that they're going to carry on collecting coins and not do it for just the cash. But at the same time, if they don't make any money, or if they lose money, then you're absolutely right. They'll be turned off numismatics. So it's a very, very fine line. What we have to do is we have to encourage them to look at the coins for the coin's sake. We have to encourage them to look at the history behind the coins. We have to encourage them to get sets of coins rather than sell them, just make some fast money. And it's only by encouraging them to look at coins in a different way, as something separate from money making, that you actually get people into numismatics proper, I think.
And I think that's why the Spend It, Save It publication is so important. I've seen two examples of that now, two editions. Has this year and the way this year's gone and everything, has that changed plans? Are you issuing a third edition, or what's the status of that, and how well received has that been?
Well, we've decided this particular year we're not going to produce one. The simple
Makes
reason
sense.
For that yeah, exactly. The simple reason is that I don't know what it's like in the States, but cash is being used less and less over here at the moment. We have a situation where an awful lot of the shops are refusing cash to keep their people safe, which I've never quite understood. I was in one of our local supermarkets the other day, and I asked for some cash back. And, you know, I wanted to hand over my debit card, get some cash back. And the woman said, well, sorry, we're not doing cash. We're not dealing in cash. And I said, what do you mean you're not dealing in cash? Oh, it's to keep us safe. And I looked at the conveyor belt of grocery items that I'd picked up. And I said to her, I'm slightly confused. I've just picked up all of these grocery items and I've put them on the conveyor belt. You have just handed them to me. So you've touched them. Each one of these could have been touched by somebody else or many people in the shop. And yet you're not handling cash to keep you safe. But you've not got gloves on. You've not got hand sanitizer here. So as a consequence, you know, why is handing me cash any less safe than handling all the grocery items? And of course, I then realized that she was only doing her job and that these instructions had come from on high. So I was really wasting my time talking to the poor girl. But ultimately, this year, we've got a situation where cash isn't being used quite as much. So we decided that there was very little point in producing a third edition of Spend It, Save It this year, because the interest isn't as obvious as it was 2 years ago, simply because there are fewer people shopping, fewer people using cash. Doesn't mean that it won't come back, but we've just produced our coin yearbook this year, which contains all the information anyway. That's something that also contains information on other coins, so Celtic, Roman, etc. So we thought, well, we'll stick to that one this year, and then we'll see how things go, because obviously no one knows what the heck is going on right now.
Yeah. And I will say, I've told you this before, and I mean it. I mean, this is not just bloviating to preen to the guest, but
yeah,
I love the coin yearbook because it's now granted, I did just buy the Spink published stuff as well.
Yeah, sure.
But because that serves a different role for
absolutely
me,
right.
The more academic, yep. The more market-based, the more. But the coin yearbook, all in one, is it still £10, or have you had to bump that up?
It's still under £10, £9.95. Now, thing about the two books, you're absolutely right. That the Spink publication is the one that has every single grade, every single mint mark and variety and everything else. It is for the pure numismatists. It's for the people out there who want to know every intricate detail about their coins. The coin yearbook is far more for everybody. It's an everyman publication. It's for the, you can pick it up if you literally have a box of coins left to you by granddad and you have no idea what they are. Or you can pick it up and use it if you're a dealer. That's the aim we've tried to go with it. And when the Spend It Save It was one step down from that, and it was aimed purely at the brand new collector, someone who was just doing the 50p's for the fun of it.
Awesome. Well, I think there are some lessons here for all of us in publishing and in collecting, and I look forward to the time again when I can bring my British coins over and spend them and redeem them at Metro Bank there in London, because I am an Anglophile at heart, and I love coming to – that's probably my favorite city, and I want to come back to a CoinEx or one of the coin shows there, and when I do, I'll be sure to hang out with you, meet up with you. Thank you so much for your time and good discussion. Really enjoyed today, and I think this will serve our audience and collectors here who want to know more about the markets. This will serve them well.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
So that was our interview with Phil Mussel. We hope you enjoyed this little detour to the British Isles.
And if you did, if you enjoyed our discussion, if you enjoyed any of the segments, if you've enjoyed any of our previous content, please remember to keep on listening every week and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And until next week,
happy collecting.
Thank you for listening to the Coin World Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and we'll see you next week. Send us your questions and feedback on Facebook at facebook.com/coinworld or on Twitter at coinworld. Be the first to know about our next episode by signing up for our newsletter. Go to coinworld.com and click on free newsletter to sign up today. This episode of the Coin World Podcast was brought to you by the Coin World Marketplace. All the safety, trust, and convenience you'd expect from Coin World. With over 40,000 coins available, visit coinworld.market to explore our inventory today.